Jen Zamperali on 2FM with Leia Healthcare. Always a beat ahead. Visit leiahealthcare.ie. Leia Healthcare, looking after you always.
Listen to this. An Irish Paralympian is currently training for an upcoming charity marathon, and that it is, that will see him run the length of the country in 5 days. It's incredible, a monumental undertaking for any 33-year-old to attempt. But for Peter Ryan, it's going to be a bit more of a challenge. And to tell us why, he joins me now. Peter, you're very welcome to the show.
Thanks, Emil.
How are you?
Yeah, like that. Like, you're doing things like this, you kind of realise there is a bit of pre-game nerves. Starting on Sunday, had a nice little call with my sister last night. She was like, one of those are you nervous calls, and you're not at the start of the call, and then you realise you are at the end of the call. So she used the term, this is at-risk behaviour. So she's a social worker. She really started throwing her work terminology at me. But we all have
one of those siblings.
Yeah, exactly. No, all in all, look, the support has been class. Like, it's the week of it now. I'm just looking forward to kind of getting started. It's kind of that weird space of like, I just want to start. I've rested up. The training is done. I'm not going to get any fitter and just let it happen.
You're ready to go.
As ready as you can.
Why are you doing this?
Why am I doing it? We could land that plane in a lot of places, but I suppose ultimately, so like I said, I'm a former Paralympic athlete. I'm legally blind myself. So the NCBI obviously is a charity. It just means a huge deal to me. And I probably lost a bit of that connection when I, like, so early doors, they would have been a support network. Like, I lost myself at 20. So you have to relearn how to do an awful lot of things, from using a laptop to using a washing machine to walking to the local shop to you're getting all that kind of support network stuff. And then that found me obviously gravitating back to sports, which was obviously my strong suit. And you go off and you have a great little life and you kind of forget about it, because I was immersed in the Paralympics. I was kind of getting that connection with the world of disabilities, with just like having, I suppose, that identity, which was a big angst for me, like running away from the word disability, running away from blind, and Paralympian almost made it cool. And I enjoyed it and whatever. And then when I retired, I realised like I'm actually missing that connection. And that charity does an awful lot of good work day to day. And there's families going through weekly what we went through 10, 12 years ago. And look, I suppose the run itself, it's out there. I like doing these kind of big ideas and just seeing, can we make it happen? And
what did your sister call it?
At-risk behaviour.
At-risk behaviour. Peter.
She'll thank me a lot for that one now, yeah.
She's right. Good on her. You need someone like that, I'd say, in your life, because I say you're prone to doing all this kind of mad stuff, which is great in a way. But can we go back to when you were diagnosed? I mean, I can't imagine. I'm sure there's people listening going, oh my God, I don't know how I would cope or how I would handle getting news like that. So you were 19 years of age.
Yeah, I was 19. Like I say, normal life, like anyone that knows me, I suppose, knows this bit of it, but I was playing hurling with my senior team, same as any other year, pre-season, and started making a few mistakes. Long story short, thought I needed contact lenses, went for an eye test, and there was a bit more going on than needing contact lenses. I actually had a blur in one eye at that stage, and whole thing kind of snowballed from there. Lot of testing, lot of what is it, a lot of scary conversations, ruling this out, ruling this in, all that kind of stuff. So eventually, yeah, I got a diagnosis called Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy. Not expecting anyone to memorise that or know it or anything like it, but long story short, again, it takes 80 to 90% of your vision over the space of about 12 to 14 months. So have some of that and figure it out and off you go and walk into the world and try and piece that one together. So yeah, it was pretty crazy.
Do you remember the day you got that news, that diagnosis?
Oh yeah. Like, even, you know, whatever it is, 10, 11 years later, I can, like, even talking about through this, like, I can go back to that place so quickly. Like, it's it's the sentence, it's the room that changed your life, do you know what I mean, forever. And like I say, I'm talking to you here now, it hasn't all been for the worst, but back then you couldn't see that. Back then you're just numb, you're in the room, you're getting the diagnosis and you're told. Everything is very clinical, obviously it's a medical setting, but it's like, you won't go fully blind, like it's an X chromosome, you can't give it to your kid. Like, the solace I was being given in that room was actually, there was no solace whatsoever. Like, telling me I can't go fully blind when you're that age, well, what's not fully blind? None of us think of like our eyesight in percentages or fractional points or anything like that. And I couldn't give it to my kids, so I would say like, family planning wasn't high on the agenda either.
Not
so it's
for
like,
a 19-year-old.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? So it's like, right, sound, good to know. That'll be on, you know, my
I'm just
profile.
Gonna go to the pub for a sec. deal with this.
Yeah, it's not much of a chat up line, like, is it?
Yeah. Okay. So how did you deal with it? Did you we were talking off air and you were telling me there was a time where you went to a bit of a dark place.
Yeah, like that. By degrees, you realise you're not dealing with it. I did all the usual stuff, first of all. Like, I would have been putting up the fronts. I was 19, I was 20, and it was huge news in the local area as well. Like, say, I'm a rural lad and I was sports mad, and all of a sudden work is becoming a bit harder, and then, like, you're not driving the car anymore, you're not playing sports. And, like, I always kind of tell people, like, I ended up socialising to the point that I became antisocial. Like, drink was a place where I was always trying to keep everything as normal or the way it used to be. That was all I was chasing, was normality. This is fine. This is same. This is whatever. And, like, yeah, I'd found a little bit of solace in that. Like, and obviously when I was drinking, I was getting out of my head, which was super healthy. I was having a laugh. And it was kind of an environment that I felt the same as the lads. If anything, I could be better than the lads. Do you know what I mean? Like, it was like, but, like, obviously that's whatever, making light of it. But I definitely did. I took that to its fullest. And that's something I think a lot of men do. We, like, don't find advice. Like, drink was definitely my one. Maybe, do you know what I mean? The combination of not talking and drinking was definitely a huge debilitating factor. Like, it ended up in me going to a treatment center. So, like, I do always kind of promote that advocacy around, like, talking about it. And just, like, you don't, like, I'm a big believer, you don't have to end up in a treatment center to solve the problem. Like, just because that was my story, like, there was a lot of junctures where I could have started talking to people, but I just physically wasn't able. I didn't know how, and I didn't even know how to be visually impaired. I didn't have role models. I didn't know what it meant. Every picture I painted was, like, the worst possible version, that you can't have the girlfriend, or you can't have a, do you know, what's the point, like, messing about the kids there a few minutes ago. But it's like, sure, if you can't collect them to go to the school or whatever, like, you just start saying you're not as kind of,
you're not going to have a normal, happy life.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Because you just don't know. Like, do you know what I mean? Your archetype is just someone that you've seen once, and you're starting to say, well, oh, I don't know, does he have a job? Or I don't know, does he have this? And it's like, what is that like? Without exploring it, without ever trying. I suppose that was the big debilitating piece.
I can imagine. And coming to terms with the cards you've been dealt with. So what was the turning point?
Well, like I say, I did go into that treatment centre, and that was like, that was huge for a guy.
Started talking.
Yeah, it was 28 days, like, and taking away the drink and whatever, like, just say that was the vehicle I used to destruct. But, like, it was 28 days to talk about it. Like, yeah, we're talking about drink, but we're talking about why am I drinking? And, like, we're talking about all the machinations of that. And it's like, I wasn't dealing with it in any way, shape or form. I was pushing people away. My token answer was, like, people asking you, how are you doing? How is this? It's like, sure, it's grand. And sure, it is what it is. And all these kind of things. And essentially, I just became this master of, like, dodging a chat, saying, like all I was really saying was, shut up, I don't want to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And pivot, and away we go. And it's like, phew, got away with that. I didn't have to actually be real with anyone ever. And inside, you're cracking up. So, like, I suppose in there, we started, like, pulling at that string, because we always think, when we're thinking negatively, we think in, like, it's a very, generally just a dramatic one sentence, and we don't really pull at the string. So I suppose in there, through counselling, through whatever, you get to kind of tease it out. It's like, well, why does that bother you? And, like, kind of go three whys into the problem, I suppose, or whatever. We might have all heard that kind of terminology. And when I was laying it down, it's like, well, I'm not terminal, and I'm here 22. I'm after letting it get to this situation, and you kind of, you're at a juncture there where you kind of realise, well, I'm either going one way or the other. And in some ways I had a lot of guilt even for ending up in there, because, like, I had such a good support network. I have phenomenal family, phenomenal friends. And you're
and
kind
community,
of like,
it sounds,
yeah,
like.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And people in my life. And it still got to that point that I couldn't lean on these people that are, like, so good and so helping and so all that kind of stuff. So I was like, no, like, I'm going to at least attempt to arc out what visually impaired Peter can do, I suppose, or what that life might look like. And that was, like I say, it wasn't a eureka, but it was finally moving that right
hope.
Direction. Yeah, exactly.
And it was hope, yeah.
And you need to start getting a bit of momentum back in your life. And then as soon, like, I had this huge list of things you can't do. And as soon as you do one of them, you kind of get, it starts becoming contagious. And it's like, right, I want to see what else I can do. And I suppose the mantra I left the treatment centre was, like, visually impaired Peter doesn't exist. So you have an opportunity to create who he is. And I suppose I wanted to use sport being one of the stronger assets that I had to kind of start itching that out and get the momentum
that
going.
That you did. Tell us about competing in Rio Olympics.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. And I always laugh, like, I was like, went from that place that we were referencing, treatment center, to the Olympic Village in 4 years. I was like, these are very two kind of institutional buildings. But but, like, it was phenomenal. Like, the games itself, 168 countries in one little village for the week. You throw in the disability piece, you throw in the fact that I like talking to people anyway, you just have these, like it's a magical world. It really is, like, and obviously it's super competitive and it's all those things, but I'm someone yeah, I'm sports mad and I'm competitive as anyone you'll ever meet, but like I can see the Paralympics for what it is, and there's different levels and it means a different thing to different people. Mm. And sport became the crutch that picked me back up on my feet and gave me a bit of my identity back. And to one person, just racing at that local race is giving them every bit as much as the games give me. Do you know what I mean? I'm not saying anyone that immerses themselves has to get to that level. I needed that because I didn't want to be just racing in an Irish context. I wanted to take it to its fullest. And that was born out of the fact I thought sport was gone forever. And as soon as you think something's gone forever and it comes back, it's like you have a lease of life. You're like, I'm not going to let go of this. I'm not going to take it lightly. I just want to, you know. So, yeah, I loved my 8 years on the Irish team. I traveled the world. Like, you think about things I thought I couldn't do. Like, I thought I couldn't get a train to go to Euston Station from Tip because I'm visually impaired. How do you do that? How do you get a plane? How do you do this? Like, I'm traveling the world. I've been to South Africa. I've been Brazil a couple of times. I've been to Japan. Sport gave me a life that I'd have never had. Mm-hmm. So I've just loved absolutely every bit of it.
This Malintmizzen run, it isn't your first endurance event in Ireland, but can you tell us about cycling around the country?
Yeah, this is where I got the first taste for it. So back in 2018, myself and my pilot at the time, so obviously I'm visually impaired, so I was on a tandem bike, but myself and Sean took on this challenge. It started off like so stupidly. It was just like a bit of a team building exercise. And
Sean must be exhausted from you. Oh, for God's sake.
Yeah, he's gone now. What are we doing now?
He
joined the guards. He was like, do you know what?
I need a break.
Yeah. I need a life job because this is too much commitment. No, he was brilliant. And yeah, the race around Ireland was exactly what it says on the tin. It was 2,250 something kilometres nonstop. We became the first tandem to ever complete the race in 10 years.
Unreal.
122 hours it took us to get around the country. We slept for less than 10 hours essentially the whole week. That in itself. And weirdly, like you think you'd never do something like that again, but I got bitten by that. That's kind of half the reason I'm doing what I'm doing now. Mm-hmm. It's like that is such a, like I said, I'm sporty anyway, but it's such a cool crossover between a sports event and psychological torture. So we're back to the at-risk behaviour bit. But like, yeah, it was like, you know, like I don't think it's necessarily this mad fitness competition. It's a belligerence and an eating competition, and you have to know why you're doing it, and you have to kind of there's a bit of soul searching goes on.
I can imagine, especially on day three.
Yeah.
So how do you do it? Do you have a pilot? How does it work?
So on the bike, it was on a pilot.
On a pilot, okay.
Yeah. So I had Sean was on the front of the tandem, me on the back. A lot of communication, a lot of trust.
Okay.
And we built that up over years, like, because I don't have even brakes on the back of the bike. So it's like, what are we doing here? Mm-hmm. It's, do you know, you're going at something like Brazil, for example, like the fastest we've ever went on a bike was like 110, 112 kilometres an hour. And like, you don't have any brakes on the back. So if that's not trust, I don't know what is. But you do it because you want to win and you're competitive and all those things. But look, like I said, the bike gave me such a leg up. It gave me a lot of my independence back. And freedom.
And I'm forever
thankful. And now I've kind of layered on. So I retired during COVID and the running has probably added to that freedom because in some ways I can go for a bit of a run on my own. I could never get out on the bike on the road on my own because mm-hmm. I just visibility wise. Whereas I have that peripheral vision, which is enough to get out and about and go for a run in Phoenix Park. And do you know what I mean? It's not without its challenges. There's a few scares and a few stories, but like, do you know what I mean? For the most part, like I love pushing kind of how far can I just, like I say, I've said it before to people, but like with a disability, and again, it's all like subjective and it's all like, this is my iteration of it. But like, I think it's really about finding that trade-off between independence and spiting myself. Mm-hmm. And for way too long, I wouldn't look for help. But you can get learned helplessness that way as well and just kind of giving into things. Whereas now I want to find out what can I do. But when I need the help, I'll put the hand out. So I think even this event is a microcosm of that. Like the amount of people I've gravitated saying, what can I do? How can I help? All that kind of stuff. It's turning into something that's a lot more than me trying to run from Malintmizzen.
I just got a text in saying, hi, Jen. I wish Peter the very best of luck with the marathon. I'm with the NCBI myself, as I'm visually impaired with no peripheral vision. I'm blind in the darkness. So thank God my sight isn't bad in the day, but that can change. I could go fully blind, but I don't know. And that's from Karina, who's just texted into the show.
Karina has a condition I'd hazard a guess, it's called retina pigmentosa. Mm-hmm. And one of the guys in my squad on the Paralympics had it. So they have tunnel vision. They have the exact opposite vision of me. And it used to be funny, like we used to go through the, not to make light, we used to go through the airport. she could see, Katie could see what I couldn't, and I could see what she couldn't. So we used to be laughing away between the four eyes. We have a set of eyes here together.
Amazing.
And we'd link arms, and she'd have night blindness, and I'd be guiding her. And there's other times where I can't read the board, so she'd bring me through places. And it's like, do you know what I mean? Like I say, that takes her to make the effort. The NCBI is helping an awful lot of people. And where do you go when you have these questions? Like, who, like, it's actually one of those things. It's touching a lot more families than we probably realize. And yeah, I just want to kind of keep that.
You're amazing. I wish you the very best of luck. I'm sure you have your whole family terrified with what you get up to, but you're just incredible in how far you come. And if people want to check out petersvision.org, people can find out more, and you can make a donation, I'm sure, through there as well. Peter, very best of luck with the run. Thank you for coming into the studio. You're an how's life now? Tell us about the personal life. What's, you know, you tell me all about
I don't
running.
Know. Are we still on air?
We're still on air. How's all life? Good there in that day.
Life is good, yeah. You kind of realise, you can have bad days and it's not because of eyesight. Do you know what I mean? You just,
sure.
Like, with ups and downs. But I've genuinely, like, not to be always on with the project, I've loved the last 6 months. It's just been, like, it's given me a sense of, like, yeah, this is class. Like, and I realise I probably need to be connecting with that part of myself a bit more. Not the stupid running bit and the ultra runs and all that, but, like, even the disability piece. Like, I'm lucky, I have a job, mm-hmm. I'm able to articulate the problems, I can actually help in some regards in that world, so I want to try and do a little bit more in that space, but day to day, yeah,
life's okay. Okay, Peter, yeah. That is good to hear, and thanks for coming in.
Jen Zamparelli on 2FM with Leia Healthcare. Always a beat ahead. Visit leiahealthcare.ie. Leia Healthcare, looking after you always.